KBSI in the world. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. He's here to help me understand the success of AUKUS, meeting what Gregory observes as a cultural strength, except the short version is this. Australians, when they describe themselves to Gregory in the 21st century, emphasize mateship, that is, getting along. And my experience with Australians, such as Gregory and his colleagues, many Australians, cheerful, wonderful, friendly bros, very good-natured, always happy to see you. You're always happy to see them. But, Gregory, I can't find a negative in mateship. However, there is one when it comes to sovereignty and strength into 2050. Please help me understand.
Well, one of the things about Australians is their unwillingness to rock the boat. They tend to go along with things. They are essentially, you know, strong on mateship. This is the we did a survey when I wrote a study in 2007 called Australia 2050, looking at Australia and its future to the mid-century. And I asked Australians to describe what they felt were Australian, the characteristics of Australians, and to describe the country and where they wanted to be. And the only thing they could talk about was, well, our ethos is mateship. You know, we look after our mates and we're loyal. And loyalty is very, very important to Australians. And they are loyal to a fault, to the point where they will defer to their chosen leader. And for many years, the chosen ally was the United Kingdom, which from which Australia in its modern iteration derives. And so it was literally up until the fall of Singapore in 1941-42 that that Australia clung to its dependency on Britain or its deference to Britain. After that, they turned to the United States, and that's been the case literally ever since. Australia, with the population that it has, it's a small population, it's less than 30 million at the moment, but its GDP is very strong. It could have been playing the role of an independent sovereign leader within the region, and yet it's always backed away from that. That's always been a little too embarrassing. And part of that, I think, comes from the origins of the different states in Australia. And of course, most Americans keep thinking of Australia as a former penal colony. And that indeed was the origin of Sydney as the big city, which was where penal settlements were set up for convicts who'd been sentenced in Britain to transportation. And they could no longer send them to the penal colony in Georgia in the United States or in America. And they sent them to Australia. So you had that colony on the East Coast growing as one which was comprised largely of people who either worked for the government or were subdued by the government. So they became a very statist society. On the West Coast, however, in Perth, where I'm from, this was a free settlement of Scottish, largely of Scottish entrepreneurs who rushed to take up the offer of free lands and the Swan River colony to avoid the French setting up colonies there. So that became very entrepreneurial. And it was not so deferential to the government as the eastern states settlements were. As a result, you had and still have many more millionaires per capita in Western Australia than you do in the eastern states. So very different outlooks. But yet the big voting numbers meant that the government was always dominated by these people who were reluctant to change the status quo and did so only with great difficulty. As a result, Australia takes a view of total dependency on its superpower ally. That's why this AUKUS deal to this point should have been a deal between equals, Britain, United States, and Australia, not necessarily in sizes of economy, but in terms of their sovereign rights. And yet Australia deferred to a deal on the submarines, for example, which would bind it into the U.S. Literally forever, certainly into the well into the foreseeable future because of the technology conditions imposed on that deal. Now, but most Australians think, well, haha, we've now locked the Americans into supporting us into the indefinite future. But the reality is that means Australia doesn't get to make the same kind of independent choices which it should, if it is to be a sovereign country, undertake.
The Australia of 2050, that was the part where you got my attention. Loyal mates in 2050. But what else? Because the plans for AUKUS include the building of submarines that are particular to the shallow waters of the Indo-Pacific. And also, once you have that power, you're projecting naval power into the growing part of the planet where all the people are, which is Asia. Do Australians think that they're in time going to be a leader and not a follower?
Well, I don't think Australians think about it either way. There are some who think that they should, that Australians shouldn't be just slavishly following the United States. And the submarines, though, do give Australia an independent strike and power projection capability. But the reality is that you have to maintain them with technology, which has to be licensed from the United States. And there'll be, you know, an interdependence between Australia, the US and the UK technologically. So it won't be as though Australia can make a lot of independent strategic decisions at any stage if it wants to keep its technology supply chain going. Now, it could have integrated, I think, more easily and readily into the Indo-Pacific theater if it had more independence from the United States. And I think that would be beneficial to the United States as well. The United States certainly counts on Australia, even today, before nuclear submarines, for Australia's capacity in that region. But it's a point of whether the Australians should be looking after their own interests first and the alliance interests secondarily. That's where we're coming to the discussion. Where is Australia going to be? Is it going to be an independent country? A lot of people have referred to it as, if you like, a de facto state of the United States at a time when many United States states are talking about secession themselves.
Let's look at a specific example and see how, in action, Australia either defers or must take the lead. Recently, conversations between the Prime Minister of Japan, Kishida, and the President of South Korea, President Yoon, about the threat of the People's Republic of China and also of North Korea. Now, neither of those states have been invited or do I see mentioned in terms of AUKUS, but that would strengthen AUKUS, that would strengthen Australia's reach. Australia is a continent, for heaven's sakes, Gregory. It's a continent that bottles up China, and that would be extremely important if South Korea and Japan want to be successful in a combat with China. Is Australia planning to take that conversation lead, or does it wait for the U.S. to say, go ahead and talk to Tokyo?
Well, I think before you get an expansion of AUKUS to include Japan and South Korea, you'll see discussions about the inclusion of Canada and New Zealand, because they're both members of the Five Eyes Intelligence Exchange. However, that won't occur until we see finally the changes of government in Canada and New Zealand, because right now those two countries are not trusted by the rest of the Five Eyes agreements, despite the fact that they are part of the common structures, security structures, which are represented in AUKUS. However, there are separate bilateral agreements between the US and Japan, between Australia and Japan, between the US and South Korea, and so on. And there's a strong friendship between South Korea and Australia. So you don't need to expand AUKUS to include Japan and South Korea, because AUKUS is a global strategic alliance. It's not an Indo-Pacific one, and it's not specifically geared against the People's Republic of China. It gives a global reach to three allies who have traditionally operated globally. Japan and South Korea are not in that same argument. They are allied absolutely with the AUKUS powers when it comes to the containment of the People's Republic of China, but AUKUS literally, and the submarine deal particularly, is aimed at a world after the collapse of the communist Chinese government. Because, let's face it, by the time Australia gets its indigenous nuclear attack submarines, the AUKUS SSNs, it's probable that the People's Republic of China will have collapsed economically and will gradually subside as the great military threat which it now is. So what does that mean? That means AUKUS has to now shape its role as a post-China alliance, one which in fact projects, if you like, power or the continuation of the Western-dominated, rules-based social and legal order well beyond the collapse of the People's Republic of China. And nobody is thinking about what that world might look like, because will it include the collapse of Russia as a strategic power? Will it include the rise of other powers such as India? But the reality is that AUKUS and the allies of AUKUS, such as Japan and South Korea, will have to be thinking about what the shape of the world will be in 15, 20, and 50 years' time.
Can you imagine Australia having a difference of opinion with the U.S. about how to deal with the People's Republic of China as it deteriorates? For example, we have news now that the administration is looking to tamp down its criticism about lethal aid to Russia, not to drive Xi Jinping into Putin's arms. Whatever the metaphor is, there's news about this from NBC. Can you see Australia dissenting from this soft hands with Xi?
No, I think particularly under the Labour government of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese in Canberra, I think they also want to tamp down any overt provocation of Beijing, and they certainly don't want to drive him into the arms of Russia, although what's happened is that they have already driven Moscow into the arms of Beijing. But we saw, even in the last 24 hours, the Australian Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister, Richard Marles, making the comment that if the United States went to war to protect Taiwan from a PRC invasion, then Australia would not necessarily enter that war on the side of the United States and Taiwan. So already you see that that's really quite a brittle situation there, despite the fact that on the first day he was in office, Prime Minister Albanese said that Australia would do whatever the United States did in such a war, because you might recall President Biden on, I think it was May 24th last year, was asked in Tokyo whether the United States would come to the military aid of Taiwan, and he said yes. And then the question was posed to Albanese, who said, we will do what the United States will do. Well, we're now seeing that both President Biden and Prime Minister Albanese are walking back on that to some degree. They certainly don't want to say it. Whether they'll do it is another question altogether.
Is there dissent in the U.S. about bringing Australia into this mix? Is there dissent in Britain? Is there hesitation because of Australia's very... It's a population from all over Asia. It's not necessarily Whitehall.
Well, it's true, but yet what we've seen is that the immigrant population in Australia has, to a large degree, adopted British values. The Hong Kong Chinese, for example, very, very pro the empire, if you like, in the old sense. But a lot of immigrant Australians, whether they're and by the way, a huge number are from Europe, Greece and Italy in particular. And by and large, they've become very conservative, very supportive of the continuation of the monarchy, for example. Right now, the monarchy in Australia is getting support from about 80% of the population, whereas the support for Australia becoming a transactional political republic has declined dramatically, even though the present government thinks that it's going to find a way to transform Australia into a republic. The tenor of the population has been largely to support the status quo. I think that Australians regard themselves as having a special relationship with Britain still. The UK government does not have a problem in dealing with Australia and has really ramped up its support for Australia in the post-Brexit period, whether that was under Boris Johnson or Rishi Sunak, the current Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. They're both very, very much in favour of bringing Australia back under closer ties and offering Australia whatever support it needs. And Australia has participated in a number of major defence programs with Britain lately, not just the nuclear submarines, which will critically involve Britain, because Britain will be building the first of the Australian AUKUS SSNs, the nuclear submarines. They're also Britain and Australia cooperating on programs for frigates and the like.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defence and Foreign Affairs, looking at Australia in 2050. We're going to turn to Great Britain in 2023. My favorite moment of the week, the King Charles Report. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.